Hi everyone, this is Philosophy of the People with Ben Burgess and Stephen Bertram. And there's some amazing news in chat this week that someone read the article. For those that may not be aware, this is a show where Ben writes an article on a Sunday and puts it on a Substack, and then we read it. Well, we don't read it on air. I read it. Ben's presumably in some sense reads it. And then we talk about it on the show. And the article this week reminded me that I'd made up a philosophy phrase, which, because it has two made up words in it, if you Google it, the only result you get is me. But the concept is lumen breedum, and points to anyone that can guess what that rhymes with and what the point of it is. Because this came up with me trying to explain to people, like, not arguing for any particular view on free will, but just trying to lay out the state of the debate, because I think it's often very much just like that on a completely basic level is completely misunderstood, I think. So lumen breedum, I define an important point to understand in the free will debate is that the normal view in terms of denying free will and in inserting free will both agree with a picture of the world and of the subject wherein a normal adult human has this property, which we can call lumen breedum, where they can make rational and reasonable decisions about their life, and barring outside interference, delusion, or whatever else, these choices will have effects on the world consonant with these decisions and on themselves at least some of the time. For those who believe we have free will, they think lumen breedum is sufficient for human freedom, while those who deny it think that lumen breedum is insufficient for human freedom. But everyone agrees that we have lumen breedum. So it's not the case that the dividing line between free will skeptics and those that believe in free will is whether or not we have the ability to make conscious, rational decisions. That's a background assertion that essentially everyone universally accepts.
Yeah, that seems right. How did you come up with that name? Maybe if I saw it written down, I would get it. I've been trying to piece it together.
I thought you'd get it because I was saying lumen breedum, human freedom.
Oh,
lumen
there we go.
Breedum,
there we
human
go.
Freedom.
There we go.
You switch the letters.
There we go. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I like that a lot, actually. So if you're that's right. So that seems right. In practice, the debate is about whether, lumen breedum is sufficient for human freedom, which is particularly relevant here because part of what the essay kind of takes a minute on is that, like, look, you could, would be things that were true that would make lumen breedum not exist, right? Like if a sort of extreme kind of eliminativism about consciousness were true, right?
It's kind of some version of denial of lumen breedum is often advocated outside of philosophy. Like, for instance, you can see it not all the time, but sometimes it seems to be what Sam Harris is suggesting. Where he like, for instance, he argues that through meditation, he realized he doesn't actually make decisions or something like this.
Yeah, right. Exactly. He does say things like that. And it's very strange, right? Because he really, I really think that the error he's making there might be as simple as, true premise. There are lots of things that are like actions you undertake or thoughts that you have that are not based on any sort of deliberation or anything like that, right? That it's all the sort of, it just kind of bubbles up from the murky depths of your mind, and you couldn't reconstruct why you did it to save your life, right? Absolutely true premise. Notably, I think nobody's ever denied that, there are people who'd say, oh, well, that doesn't count as an action or whatever. But like at that point, we're just doing semantics. Like nobody denies the phenomenon happens, right? You know, that, you know, it's like, oh, why did you do that? You know, I don't know. Right. Like that's totally a thing that happens.
But, right. People do this with like AI, where they're like, are we not all next token predictors? Which is like, yeah. Sometimes I'm something like a next token predictor, like when I'm answering on like autopilot. But most of the time I'm not.
Yeah. Again, I think that he really might be making a mistake as simple here as just like, clearly it's true that this is the thing that happens, that like some portion of what's going on in our minds answers to this description. Therefore, like that's all that's going on in our minds. Cause otherwise if he's not making that mistake, I really don't know how to make sense of
I've said it before on the show, but it's like, you know, if you argue for that you are like a next token predictor, or you're like this thing that Sam Harris describes, maybe it's true for you, but it's not true for me. I think about things at least some of the time.
Yeah, at least some of the time, surely, right? I'd like to think nearly all of us at least sometimes think about things before we do them. You know, we, as the man we're talking about this afternoon says, we act for reasons that we can, you know, consciously represent to ourselves, right? That seems like a thing that, you know, pretty much everybody does. It would be really difficult to imagine, you know, like somebody who was recognizably human who didn't do that, you know, at all, right? Like
and that they were allowed like outside of the house on their own.
Certainly none of that, right? Like that's one way of denying that we have lumen freedom, and then another would just be like, again, I think if I understand it correctly, some of the sorts of the things that the, you know, churchlings say about philosophy of mind might get you there, or at least come close enough that you can see how they could be extended to get you there, where you say things like, oh, well, you know, we think that, you know, oh, I do X because I believe that Y, and, you know, and I have the goal that Z. And so I'm attributing all these propositional attitudes towards myself, right? You know, that I have, you know, beliefs about, you know, things that are true. I have, you know, I have, you know, desires that, you know, states of affairs, you know, come about, et cetera. And again, I, you know, it's been a long time since I thought about this stuff, but, you know, my understanding at least, and I did run this by, you know, a couple of friends who have, you know, who like spend more time with this literature than I do. Like, I think one of them said, if this is a mistake about what the Churchillians think, it's a common enough mistake that you can't be faulted, you know, for saying it.
They should have been clearer.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, they would say, well, that's all like folk psychology, right? You know, this way that we're understanding, you know, what's going on in our minds, that really it's the
user experience, as Dennett says.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, and this is also another reason I was bringing up the Churchillians, because it's an interesting contrast point, because there are certain things that Dennett thinks about mind that, you know, come close enough to, you know, to this, to, for, you know, that like you, that like the question reasonably arises, right? Like that, like, okay, how do I classify Dennett's own views with regards to this stuff? And he's, you know, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, again, you know, I mean, he says things like, we act for reasons. We represent those reasons to ourselves consciously, right? You know, so like there is like a lot of what we normally believe about our mental lives that I think he does still end up validating. But there's a lot that he doesn't validate, right? Like about how we normally understand our mental lives. And, you know, there are even things that it's like, yeah, it might be reasonable. So the Churchland's position, it's usually called eliminativism. So a reductive account of something is you're saying, oh, well, there's sort of nothing to that thing above and beyond these more basic elements that make it up. So we're all like reductionists about water, right? That, you know, we think that it's just, you know, hydrogen and oxygen, you know, atoms in a certain configuration, that that's all that water is. Whereas an eliminativist is somebody who says, no, it's not that the higher order thing that we think exists, but it's just made up of the lower order thing. It's that the higher order thing we think exists, we're just mistaken about that, right? That this is, so, you know, less like water than like witchcraft, right? You know, modern science doesn't give us a better understanding of how witchcraft works. It's just that, you know, we now understand that there's no such thing. So I think there are, clearly things that, that it's not an eliminativist about, but there are certain things about the way that, you know, like that you maybe could reasonably describe his view as a form of eliminativism. And he himself, in sort of directly answering this question, is entertaining, but not always like super clarifying. Or, I mean, I think it's clarifying, but in a way that requires a little bit of patience. Because, he'll say things like, look, how do you ultimately classify, you know, my view? This is like the philosopher's appendix at the end of Consciousness Explained, right? Like says, how do you ultimately classify my view? And he goes through all these sort of isms that it could be. He's like, I don't know, man. Here's what I think. Is it really that important for you that you have like a little couple word summary? Like, you know, like, do we need something to print on the t-shirt?
People love to have names of things. I think some people think philosophers are like work at the dictionary. So get more questions and ask philosophy where it's like, well, what's the definition for this? And it's like, well, like, why would we know? Beyond the fact that we read lots of books.
Yeah, right. Which is like the sort of thing that I think, you know, the point that Dennett's making there that I can sympathize with is he's saying, like, look, why don't I give you like a paragraph? Right? Like this is the thing that I
mean, it also relates to what he said in that video that you included in the essay. But because we haven't done it, do you want to go over the basic idea of the essay?
Sure, yeah. So, as I'm sure somebody will be learning the first time from tuning into this video.
Daniel, in a very weird way.
Yes, very weird way to learn it. I hope nobody who ever met him is learning it this way. But yes, Daniel Dennett passed away 8 days ago. So, you know, one way or the other, I'd probably be writing something about him for today, since he was a really important philosopher. But the particular sort of framing of what I wrote is about the New York Times obituary of him, since this is, gotta say, kind of appalling to me, because, you take, like, even now, right, in an age of declining, you know, traditional media in many ways, of, you know, fractured media landscape, whatever, still, I mean, got to be either the most prestigious newspaper in the English speaking world or like, you know, in the top couple, right?
There was a big drama recently because they weren't being nice enough to Biden, right? So that indicates that they're a big deal.
Yeah, exactly, right? That people are that worked up about it, right? I mean, like, in some ways, yeah, that is sort of ultimately, you know, the ultimate compliment that people continue to pay to it, that, like, from a variety of perspectives, you know, they get very mad about the things that people say there, because again, yeah, it's the it's still, you know, even with the decline of the larger landscape, you know, it's still a big enough deal for that. And, something I said that I actually ultimately had cut for length is the amazing thing to me about this obituary is like, I mean, come on. There are so many like writers, academics who would like claw each other's eyes out for like a chance to write this. Like, could they not have assigned this to somebody?
Yeah,
who
I mean, you said like they could have asked Sam Harris to do it. It probably would have been totally better. I was like, yeah, it almost certainly would be.
Yeah, it would definitely be better.
Because at least he'd get across the point that the two disagreed, while this article doesn't get that point across at all.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, I fucking hate Sam Harris, but I have I would absolutely rather read the Sam Harris obituary of Dennett. So yeah, the actual one that they ran was really, really bad, both in the sense that there are sort of specific things in there that I think are like unfair, but also like more importantly, in the sense that this is, yeah, fair enough, Silver, that this is, yeah, I think more importantly, in the sense that they got his basic positions wrong. Right. That if you
backward,
right. It's yeah. Not just like wrong in the sense that it's like slightly misstated. It's sort of at a 90 degree angle or something, but like
the Churchland Dennett stuff is like kind of forgivable, but the free will stuff is just a disaster.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So there are two things here, right? One is has to do with what we were just talking about, right? That they, you know, obviously one of the core subjects, I mean, probably like, I don't know, maybe like the three things, right? Yeah. The three things that he wrote about the most were mind, free will, evolutionary biology, and religion, right? I mean, that seems like the big four. And the religion stuff, I guess they got right. Right, they got that he's an atheist.
like Catholic philosopher dies.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't do that. Credit where credit's due. The evolutionary biology stuff, I actually strongly suspect they did fuck up a little bit, but I would have, you know, I wasn't quite sure about it, so I left that out. But you know, because like they seem to be like I know what they're talking about, so it's certainly not like a clean reversal of his position, but when he's like says only natural selection, like selective pressure could explain anything, this feels a little bit like a straw man to me, right? Does he really say only?
Right. Yeah, like usually he doesn't explain like the track of comets.
Well, right. But yeah, like, but even, you know, even biologically, like, this is a, it's like, I don't know, it's like, was Dennett committed to, I mean, like, I know he was like critical of people who played them up in a certain way or assigned them too much importance, but it's like, did he think that like nothing is a spandrel, right? That the, that like, that it's like all selective pressure. I don't know. Right. Like I said, I'd at least put a question.
We should do a show on evolution at some point, a natural selection, because I think it's one of the, like something, as opposed to like free will, where lots of people will, like online, especially like young men or whatever, with free will, they'll say it doesn't exist and they don't understand what it is. But and you know, with, the same with God and stuff like this. But evolution is interesting because people will say they believe in it, but they don't know what it is.
Yeah, but they don't actually understand how
they think it's totally. Like, you know, where animals fight and the big one wins.
Yeah, that's like that's the that's definitely the like Reddit understanding of evolution. But and then like, yeah, look, I mean, I used to do a thing in intro to philosophy classes. You know, I'd teach it like Miami-Dade, it's a community college in South Florida, where like I'd talk about like William Paley and the, you know, argument from design for the existence of God. And, you know, I'd sort of try to sympathetically draw it out. I was like, of course, when Paley wrote this, you know, here are the two options that people are familiar with, you know, that like people are familiar with, you know, supernatural design, random chance. But now, of course, there's a third popular explanation of why life of all the sort we see around us exist. What's that? And then somebody would say evolution and be like, okay, awesome. All right, fill out the rest of this phrase for me. Evolution by, and it would always depress me how long it would take, or sometimes nobody would say, you know, natural selection. And yeah, I think that there's like, I think there are a lot of people who are, or at least think they are Darwinists only because they're not religious and they have a sort of vague sense that that's what like the smart scientists say happened, but like they couldn't, even though the sort of, you know, obviously it's a very complicated subject and, you know, and I'm very, very far from being an expert, you know, but like, you know, there's like a basic couple sentences, like version of the mechanics of it. That's very, very easy to understand. Yeah, right. Yeah. Like they still don't have that, right? Like they just sort of know that.
Yeah, people like, think like species change and it has something to do with like them dying or fighting or surviving or something like this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, religion times basically gets position right. Biology, I suspect a certain amount of straw manning, but I'm not certain about that.
And it could be Dennis' fault. It could be a thing where he's saying one thing and he means something slightly different.
Yeah, no, that's true. He did do that. And then three, consciousness, where we already touched on a little bit, but I think they're importantly getting his view at least somewhat wrong, right? And maybe it's worth lingering on this for a second because we kind of laid the groundwork for this earlier, talking about eliminativism and some of Dennett's ambiguities and all that. But like, I think Dennett, you know, like Dennett says a bunch of interesting and fairly radical things about philosophy of mind, but, and we could unpack what those are, but I think the sort of top line thing here that's frustrating is that the New York Times obituary says that he like denied that consciousness exists, you know, that, and that's really not it. Right. Like, or at least,
you know, I mean, the New York Times has him being like a denier of God, exactly. Consciousness of free will.
Yeah. And let's
well, like, actually, okay, he was a denier of God, but for the others two, he said, they do exist, but not how you think they do.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So his, you know, what, like, it's one thing to say that Dennett's account isn't like adequately capturing what everybody else is talking about. Right. That's a sort of reasonable critique you could, you know, you could make, and then we'd have to fight about whether it's true. Right. But I mean, like that's an argument that if like you told me you were going to make that argument, be like, all right, I'll hear you out. Right. Like tell me why. But like, that's clearly not what Dennett thinks he's up to. Right. Like he, you know, I mean, again, just on the most basic level, right. His big classic book about this is called Consciousness Explained, not like Consciousness Debunked. Right. Like, you know, he
consciousness owned.
Yeah. God, like he clearly
destroyed.
Exactly. He clearly thinks what he's doing is he's providing a naturalistic account of how consciousness works, which is in many ways a surprising account, a counterintuitive account. It doesn't validate everything that we thought was true by any means. Right. But he's still like he thinks that he's validating. Yeah, exactly, Jody. You know, he thinks that he's validating, like that he's telling you new things about, you know, he's telling you things that you didn't realize were true about consciousness. Which again, he certainly doesn't think that what he's up to is telling you that there just is no such thing. And the reason that some people, you know, would say that in effect, he thinks there's no such thing, I think we have to get into the details of the view a little bit to get, right? But I think that first point is just really important because if you read this review, you're just reading him say, oh, he's just denying it. It's like, well, again, he sure doesn't think he is. Right. So yeah, I mean, Dennett has, and, you know, maybe you'll be able to explain this better than I do. Cause I think that, given some of what you expressed last week, right. You know, I think that you might, you know, like you might be more immersed in some of this, but like, you know, I think on the sort of most basic level, right. Dennett is denying a couple of things that are widely thought to be true. Right. So one of them is that he thinks that user experience that you mentioned, right. That sort of like, I think I'm being very careful about the phrasing because I want to get this right. But like, I think what he would say is the sort of like mistaken belief that we kind of all naturally have about how consciousness works is that there's what he calls a Cartesian theater so you have all this information that comes in from your senses, and then it's like you are like watching like a single movie that's been like assembled together from all of this information. And you know, Dennett would ask, well, hold up, who's this you that you're talking about, right?
You're watching the screen with what are there, like, things in his head, and what's in his head apart from the things which see, is there thinking going on in there, and so on and so on.
Yeah, exactly, right? Is there like the little man in your head who's like watching the screen, and that's you, right? Like and that's separate from the people or the whatever it is that's doing this, like assembling. It's all very confusing, right? Is like, look, if you want to be a materialist, you don't think there's like a soul that is that's taking in all this information. That's like the one person audience in the Cartesian theater. Then like, I think that he says, yeah, he is going to be like an error theorist about this impression that we have about how it works, right? He thinks we're just wrong about that. So he talks about, rather than the Cartesian theater model of consciousness, the multiple drafts model, where you have, so like if you're working on something like a big project, right? Like a, you know, 10,000 word essay with lots of research or something, right? Then like you might have like several word files going on at the same time because you're, because we're putting
my Google Docs is a horror show of my PhD, just hundreds of different Word documents.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And then like, you've got like the, you know, you've got like the one with like all of like Ashley's notations on it, and like the one where you're starting to put those in and you're going back and forth. Right.
And I mean, it's like, those words are stressing me out.
Sorry. So we say, okay, well, what is Stefan's thesis? Is that the word you use?
Yeah, I keep referring to him. Like, it's not your PhD. You shouldn't say that.
Okay. Well, thesis. Whatever. Thesis. Okay. So yeah, what is Stefan's thesis? Is it this Word doc? Is it this Google Doc? Is it that Google Doc? You know, it's like, well, it's the like Stefan's thesis exists scattered among many different Google Docs that, you know, and somewhat similarly, again, I think I'm getting this right. Dennett would say, well, look, there's no like one thing that's, you know, like conscious experience, that you have like multiple streams going on at any given time where, you know, information is coming in, it's being revised in various ways, right? Like this is where he will start using words like tricks and illusion, you know, to describe the way that like our, you know, experience, like the way that we would describe what's going on doesn't really match up with what is going on.
Your brain will like compensate for the tiny lag from the fact that sound obviously travels much slower than light. But your brain will compensate for the tiny lag, so it doesn't look like Right. Everyone's constantly out of sync.
Yeah, right, exactly. And
And you know, that's like, there's all these different parts of your brain, and each one's doing this kind of different thing, and they all kind of come together to give you this image of kind of your conscious experience. But Dennett's point is that if we then try and take that kind of combined image of all these different things and trying to intuit from that how all the parts that contributed to it work, that's going to be a disaster. And that's the user experience idea, where he compares that to like me trying to understand how my computer works by like using the Windows 10 interface and nothing else, not going into the actual workings of the computer or anything like that, but through the user interfaces of Windows 10, try to understand how a computer works. And that's obviously going to be a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Jordy says even this language about illusion, it gets misconstrued as denial when illusions are just that things are not what they seem. Exactly, right? So it's not illusion here.
You could say it's illusion that you're seeing things and hearing things at the same time. But that's not denying that you see things or hear things. But that just the exact way that you see things or hear things isn't kind of really how they are.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I think like that there's a, you know, like I think when we say illusion, that's better thought of by, I think, thinking about examples of like ways that we use the word illusion, like we were talking about like optical illusions, right? Like they have use the classic examples, you know, you stick an oar in the water and, you know, it appears to be bent, you know, even though it's really straight, you know, that it's not that like, when you say that, you're not denying that there's an oar, right? You're just saying that like the reality of the oar and your experience of the oar, that there's a disconnect there. It's not like a hallucination or a mirage where you're just seeing, you know.
And the fact that this happens does kind of tell you something, or at least indicates there's an interesting question about, well, how does that work? But it's a really bad idea to then try to understand how like light refracts through liquids just by kind of introspecting on your vision of the oar.
Yeah. Right. There's no way that you could that you could have like a correct theory of the light spectrum and optics just derived from like phenomenology, right? That like you just reflect hard enough on what you're experiencing and that'll get you there. And you know, I should also say, right, like that a big controversial chunk of Dennett's views on this cluster of subjects is that he one thing he is like a pretty straightforward denier about is the idea of qualia.
This was you asked for comments, but then I wasn't awake. But this was the one thing where I was going to be like, actually, it's not very straightforward.
Okay, all right. Well, let's explain what it is, and then tell me why you're reading it as, you know, or why I'm misreading it as thinking it's more straightforward than it is. So when you talk about qualia, obviously it's like a philosopher's term of art, but I mean, like what it's a term of art for is like the internal subjective experience. And particularly, of course, I know Dennett would say, well, yeah, look, the things that people think that they're talking about when they talk about qualia, those things exist. Sure. No problem. Right. But like qualia is a bad theory of what those things are, right? So and in particular, it's so the idea is that, you know, so maybe it's sort of best, most useful to sort of come into this by just running through a couple of examples of things philosophers say about it, right? So so for example, there's a classic Thomas Nagel paper, what is it like to be a bat, right? Where he says that, we can do all, you know, you can do all of the, you know, scientific study and you want all the you know, bat brain autopsies you want, right? Like, and one thing that won't tell you is the sort of inner experience of like what it's like to be a bat, right? Because that's, you know, alien from our own, because, you know, we can sort of vaguely, and, you know, Dennett actually has a thing where he's sort of, I guess he'd think of it as he's sort of deconstructing what Nagel's doing here, where he says like, well, look, he picked his example very carefully here. Cause if he said, what is it like to be like a spider? Then we'd be like, oh, maybe there isn't anything that's like to be a spider. Yeah. And if he said, what is it like to be like a dog? We might think, I actually have a pretty good handle on that. Right. Like I think I can sort of, you know, abstract from certain parts of my experience. And, you know, like I think I have a pretty good sense of what it would be like to be a dog, but then, you know, having sonar in particular is such an alien thing from our sensory experiences that it starts to feel plausible. Right. So that no matter how much he thinks you scientifically understand about how sonar works, whatever, you don't know what that like inner experience of being a bat would be like. Or for example, David Chalmers, I had a whole thing about this. I had to cut for space, but David Chalmers will say one of his arguments against the idea that consciousness logically supervenes on a bunch of physical facts, which is logically supervenes is just, this is imprecise, and people, you know, the chat who know all about this will, you know, get mad at me for saying this, but I think, you know, this is close enough to reduce us to that we really don't need to worry about it for right now. They have a, that like, but that, you know, like the thing that Chalmers is arguing against is the idea that like, I guess maybe here, you know, that like once you've got all of the physical stuff in place, then the facts about consciousness just like logically follow from those physical facts, right? And he thinks, no, it's not true, because see, we can imagine what he calls zombies, right? Philosophical zombies are sort of the opposite of movie zombies. The movie zombies
are very right, obvious.
Are very obvious, right? There's no missing who's a zombie and who's not. And they're mindless in the sense they don't seem to have like higher order, you know, functioning, but like,
they're more like bats.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's more like, yeah, what is it like to be a zombie? That's the end of the George Romero's movie, Land of the Dead. One of the characters is like, I think he has a chance to be saved or something, or like, you know, he's going to like, there's one way he could try to escape. He's like, you know what? I always wondered what it'd be like, how the other half lives, you know, he like goes off and lets the zombies bite him. Yeah. So, philosophical zombies are creatures, right? Physically humans, you know, who look like us and act like us and, have like a philosophical zombie would, you know, like if I were a philosophical zombie, I would be saying all the things that I'm saying right now and making all the gestures that I'm making right now and all of the brain states that correspond to, you know, we would intuitively want to say all the brain states that correspond to the thoughts that I'm having right now that lead me to express them. The zombie would have all those brain states, right? You cut open its head and, you know, you'd see all the stuff you'd see if you cut open my head, but, you know, lights are on, but nobody's home, right? That the philosophical zombie isn't having any experiences, right? They don't have qualia, right? That there's no, you know, if they accidentally, you know, hit their thumb with the hammer, right? They would say, ouch, and all that, but, you know, and have whatever brain states are associated with pain, but they're not actually in pain. Right. Like, so that's the sort of thing that people are thinking about when they think
like
about
everyone in the Churchland model.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Totally. One way of putting the Churchland view, especially if you're not very sympathetic to it, would sort of be like, yeah, well, I guess we're all philosophical zombies. Right. Like,
if you heard the Sean Carroll argument for physicalism via zombies.
Actually, no, I don't think I have. Oh, no, wait a second. I think Remind me, I think I have heard this, but I can't.
I think I told it before, but basically the idea is like, you know, you say that there's this thing called qualia, but you describe it, and how you describe it, a person could be exactly the same in every way, but apparently lack it. So it seems like this is a useless concept, and I don't care about qualia. And it seems just that the thing I care about is completely physical.
Yeah. So, or like there's a classic thought experiment, Mary the color scientist. So Mary grew up in a, I don't know, laboratory where that's, I don't know, like everything's black and white, right? She's never seen color in her life, but she becomes a color scientist. And so she knows everything there is to know about, you know, light waves and, you know, optics and all that stuff, right? Like everything there is to know about the science of color, Mary knows. Then one day somebody brings into the black and white laboratory, like a red apple. And we would want to say intuitively that Mary has learned something new, right? She now knows what it is like to see red, right? Like,
how did red become the color du jour in philosophy?
I don't know. I have no idea. I think, like, if you think about Mary the color scientist, you think about zombies, you know, like all of these things, right? Like, kind of give you an idea of I love Ex Machina, such a good movie.
It's a great film.
It's like the perfect union of, like, it's like very like high concept science fiction, but also it's kind of a one act play. There are like three characters with speaking lines.
Yeah,
it was fantastic. But anyway, these are all ways of kind of getting at the idea of qualia. And, you know, Dennett will say, well, look, qualia is supposed to have these various properties that, you know, he kind of thinks that it's all sort of incoherent once you really start breaking it down, that it's supposed to be private, right? You know, that we have special access to it. It's like ineffable in the sense that you can't break it down to these more basic things that it like can reduce to, etc. And, you know, he thinks that you just kind of dig into all of that and it's just like none of it makes any sense. And so, you know, the thing that I take him to be relatively straightforwardly denying is that, you know, he wouldn't equate this to consciousness, although there are lots of people who would, right? Is that there's such a thing, is that there's a sort of first person experience we have that can't be captured by third person descriptions. I think that's a fair description of the thing that he's denying, but how would you think about this?
Well, I mean, you've detailed what I was going to say in large part, because in the essay you don't mention the part about being ineffable. I got a quote here: qualia are intrinsic properties of experiences that are also ineffable, non-physical, and given to their subjects incorrigibly, as in we can't be mistaken about them. But yeah, I think the kind of objection, I think there's a big objection here between, yeah, a conflation between qualia and consciousness. Wow. In the sense that, yeah, certainly, you know, when I look at the red thing, there's an experience of its redness. But it, and especially because, the, you know, qualia is used basically as it exists in trauma and so on. It's basically like a stick to beat physicalism with. But it's this strange thing where it's like, okay, I'm looking at the red thing, and, you know, that's part of, and that's, and the kind of experience of that is some kind of event in my brain. But why are we taking from the fact that, you know, I see a red thing when I look at a red thing, some massive conclusion about the world and everything in it, that because when I see a red thing, I see red stuff, you know, that we have serious reasons to doubt physicalism?
Right. Right. Yeah. I see in the so Jordy in the chat says, I thought the canon for Mary was yellow and that she sees a banana. Maybe that's right. Maybe I just turned the yellow banana into a red apple in my head, because usually when in like
it is redness that's normally used.
Yeah, exactly. That's like the most common example. And like, and even like, not only is it like the philosopher's most common example, but I feel like even like when like a black and white, like when like a movie will do the thing where they're like having black and white film, but then they splash in some color, it seems to be like always red. Right. So like maybe that
the SSP SEP has 19 mentions of red and only 7 of green.
Jemp says Ex Machina kind of reminds me of a Tarantino film for some reason. Hey, I'm a massive Tarantino fan. I would love it if he made some movies about stuff like that.
I don't see it at all, but it would be cool.
Yeah. I don't. It doesn't particularly remind me of a Tarantino movie. I mean, I guess maybe in that, like, there's just so much talking. Right? Like, that's the. You know.
Yeah, but that would have you like. Have you seen Shogun?
I haven't. No.
That's so much talking because everything's translated to Japanese because the main English character never learns Japanese throughout the series. And so that's just maximal talking, but it doesn't remind me of Tarantino.
Yeah. But yeah, like insofar as it's kind of all dialogue, I can see that a little bit. But yeah, you're right. It's not very much like it. But again, be cool. At one point, apparently, Tarantino wanted to make a Star Trek movie, which I personally would have loved. And then also I see, just while we're on this cluster of subjects, Silver has my favorite, chat of the day, which is, Mary sees a red thing and what she learns is that she wants it painted black. Jody says, I think Dennett's denial is that Qualia is this extra something that needs further explanation above and beyond his different stances one can take towards psychological phenomenon. Yeah. I'm trying to think if that's different from, you know, from what I like, cause like here's what's relatively clear, right? That like other philosophers say, hey, there's this thing called qualia. You're not accounting for it. Dennett says, no, that's not a thing, right? Like that much I think is clear. Where it gets a little bit complicated is how much of the stuff that the philosophers are sort of other philosophers are kind of meaning to get across.
Right. Because by some people, they, you know, they're saying by qualia, they basically mean experience or what it is to be, or basically essentially they define it as consciousness, which seems really strange because qualia is definitely not thinking, right?
Yeah, totally.
There's at least, you'd hope consciousness has at least two features. And it feels like for me, thinking is much more essential than qualia.
Uh-huh.
Like you could imagine kind of a non-perceiving mind. It's hard to imagine, but I think you could just about imagine a non-perceiving mind, but you couldn't imagine a non-thinking mind.
Right. Or maybe to put that differently, I don't know the, you know, there's a sense in which you definitely couldn't imagine a non-perceiving mind, but like, I think we could at least say like it sounds less like a contradiction in terms to say.
Well, non-thinking mind sounds like a joke.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, what does that mean? What makes, you know? Yeah, I think that might be right. So yeah, I mean, so that's the question, right? Like, so I think that if you say Dennett doesn't believe in qualia, that's true, but it might suggest he doesn't believe in consciousness or experience, and he at least would dispute those. And then if you use the phrase like phenomenal consciousness, then you know that it's like, well, even people who are maybe trying to be a little bit more careful might say Dennett denies that. But then like, we sort of go around in a strange sort of circle. Cause it's like, well, are you going to like define that in a way that just says all the qualia stuff that Dennett thinks is incoherent, in which case, sure. But like, that doesn't mean that people aren't like having conscious experiences exactly. So there's at least a big,
if we go back to Lumen Breedom, right?
Yeah.
Dennett's definitely not denying anything about Lumen Breedom.
Right, for sure. Now that much is definitely clear, right? So he thinks that they like so I think Dennett, it would be fair to say, has in many ways some pretty revisionary views about like experience, which he wouldn't take to be a matter of denying that there is such a thing as experience, although a lot of unsympathetic critics would say, yeah, but it kind of amounts to that. And, you know, there's like a debate to be had there, right? But then I think what's very clear is that when it comes to like cognition, right, I don't think any fair critic would think he's denying that, right? Like I think he'd say, you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, clearly he thinks all that, right? I mean, clearly he thinks that.
I mean, it just seems very strange to me, because obviously this exists also in the conversation, always about mind and consciousness. It's kind of like, what distinguishes us from bats, for instance, right? And it seems really weird to think about what the difference between humans and bats is, or whatever. Like, maybe bats do have qualia, and you need to go lower down the animal pyramid to get there. But for whatever species, that the difference between us and them is something to do with kind of qualia and like seeing redness. Well, that seems like a much more basic feature. While what really distinguishes humans from these other things is our ability to think, our ability to kind of be self-reflective on our thinking, to plan ahead, to do mental time travel, which aren't directly to do with phenomenology.
Yeah, right. That all seems right. Like you could, like maybe you could think that experience was necessary for that, all that, although it's not really clear on the face of it why that would necessarily be the case. But
yeah, I mean, it can be necessary, but then not actually be the thing which explains the difference, right?
Yeah, totally. Even if for the sake of argument it's necessary, it's certainly not sufficient, right? Like this is I think it's pretty plausible that, you know, that bats, you know, have perceptual experiences, but it's extremely implausible that like
they do mental time travel. They're like, yeah. Hell yeah, it's 6:42, I'm gonna be eating some fruit.
Yeah, exactly.
They're feeling like they're feeling very sad because they aren't presently eating fruit or whatever.
Yeah, right. It's like, oh man, it's been so many hours. I can't wait all that time.
We're working 8 hours at the fruit factory and I can't eat any fruit at the fruit factory.
So this is so Dennett has, you know, Dennett has complicated views about consciousness. Again, I think the top line thing here is that how Dennett would describe his own project is that he's offering a naturalistic explanation of like what consciousness is, how it works, right? I think how it works maybe is better than what it is, because Dennett's sort of thinks philosophers often get too obsessed with the definitional questions, and those aren't, you know, the most interesting questions to ask a lot of the time. But Dennett takes himself as offering a naturalistic story about consciousness, which, you know, again, I think the Times obituary sort of just represents that as he's denying it, which is kind of painful to read. But then I think where it gets really egregious is the thing that I and many other people pointed out when it first came out, that like right up in the deck at the top of the article, right? Says Daniel Dennett, blah, 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 controversial philosopher who thought blah, blah, blah. And then the part that I and a bunch of other people highlighted is they're listing off his beliefs. And one of them is free will is a fantasy, which is just amazing. And also, by the way, you know, at least as of yesterday.
I checked it like 2 hours ago and it's still up.
Yeah. So it.
And it's not even like a thing where like the editor has replaced illusion, for instance, which could be basically true, with fantasy. Because then in the body, they clearly make a series of statements which shows that, no, they really mean fantasy.
Yeah. This has been up for ages. Exactly. this has been up for 8 days and it still says Dennett's denying free will. He says free will is a fantasy in the deck. And then, yeah, below there are all of these statements that are actually like even clearer than that, right? It says, you know, Mr. Dennett responded that free will, like consciousness, was based on the outdated notion that the mind should be considered separate from the physical brain. It's like, clearly he did not think any of that, right? Like this, and this is like really egregious because he, because Dennett wrote, well, wrote or co-wrote, right? He wrote two books on his own and co-wrote a book that I think I actually have behind me. Yeah, here we go.
Well, hey, successful bookshelf look, because almost all the time you go, oh, I think there's a book back there, actually, whatever.
Now that I just can't find where I put it. Yeah. Yeah, this is from like 2022, maybe this, 2021, of a book of back and forth essays between Dennett and Greg Caruso called Just Desserts, Debating Free Will. And yeah, it just, yeah, it just came out 3 years ago. So like I, you know, it's, and then like, yeah, there's elbow room and freedom evolves, right? Like, so he wrote a lot about this topic, and he really could not have been clearer again about what his top line position as he understood it was, right? That, that he thought that there's such a thing as free will, right? I mean, he's a compatibilist. In fact, I think that what makes the sort of New York Times obituary so appalling to me is that, you know, he was almost certainly the most famous compatibilist in the world, right? Like, because, you know, nobody who's not like a deep academic nerd knows who like John Martin Fisher is, right? This is like, whereas Dennett actually had a big public profile. And so he was, yeah, he's probably the most famous compatibilist in the world, and also specifically the person who the most people knew was a exactly was a compatibilist.
Ben Burgess, Biden voter, dies.
This is
there's a Dennett hater in chat, but the fate, I'm just really enjoying because he keeps calling him Dennis.
Dennis, I saw that. Yes, why are you guys saying all these nice things about Dennis? You know, which actually be funny if he just like misheard us as saying Dennis every time, and he thought that we were talking about like some guy he knew named Dennis who sucks. Like, it's like, what are you talking about? Dennis was an asshole. But yeah, like it. Dennett wrote quite a bit on this subject. And it's really amazing, right? Because it's like, yeah, I think that the, you know, again, religion, they got him right. Evolution, question mark, might be some straw man in there. Consciousness, that's definitely veering into pretty unfair territory to describe him the way they described him with no qualifications. Free will, fucking unforgivable. I mean, like, this is, again, you know, he wrote so much about this, and, you know, and his position's very, very clear, right? That he's arguing for compatibilism, that he thinks free will and determinism are compatible, that, you know, compatibilism is the position that even if we live in a deterministic worst case scenario, right, that everything that ever happens is the only thing that could have happened given total previous states of the universe, and, you know, physical laws, including crucially everything that happens in the human brain, right, is that, then nonetheless, he still thinks we have free will, that, or, you know, the way he puts it is that the varieties of free, you know, the varieties of freedom worth wanting, right, are compatible with free will, right? So somebody can say, oh, when I say we have free will, I mean that, you know, this and that, and they can like tell a little story. It's like, okay, well, I guess we don't have that, but also who gives a shit?
Yeah, like, you know, the freedom to do something different in identical circumstances, even though you'll never have identical circumstances again.
Yeah, exactly.
You're never going to have the chance to do twice to do the same, to do two different things in identical circumstances. So why are you worried about having the ability to do two different things in identical circumstances?
Yeah. And I think most people, like I think most normal people, when they hear that sentence that just heard, they would hear identical circumstances, and what they really think you mean is like very, very similar circumstances. But of course, nobody denies that we can do different things in very, very similar circumstances. The what identical circumstances mean is like, you know, you take like the great big supercomputer in the sky can do like a molecule by molecule scan of the entire physical universe, including all the neurons in your brain. And given that, there's like one scenario where you do one thing an hour later or a day later or a year later, and then like another scenario where you do a different thing an hour or a day or a year later. And it's like, well, okay, sure, that is a sort of freedom, I guess, and it's a kind of freedom that we wouldn't have if determinism is true. But, you know, I take it Dennett's point when he uses this phrase about the kinds of freedom worth wanting is like, okay, but like what, why is that like a particularly desirable form of freedom? Like what, like certainly it's not a kind of freedom that seems to have much of anything to do with like other important kind of heavyweight concepts that seem to incorporate free will, like moral responsibility. Right. Like that they have, I think that, you know, it seems like the, you know, yeah. I mean, like, it seems like that all that Lumen Breedem stuff from the beginning of the stream, like does seem much more relevant to what we intuitively think, you know, matters for, moral responsibility, at least when we're not in the sort of special context of thinking about these giant questions about determinism, which, you know, I've argued elsewhere. I think that how you frame the question impacts what people's intuitive responses are going to be. And I think there are sort of reasons for that, that once you break them down, you can break the spell a little bit. But in any case, like, I think that, but I think in ordinary non-philosophical contexts, if you ask most people, it's like, okay, what, in what sense does something have to be up to somebody for it to be for it to be their fault, right? If they did it, or to their credit, you know, that they did it. And I don't think they would start going on about neurons and, you know, all that stuff. I think that
well, if we begin from the Big Bang, we see that due to a line of causes that would have been all involve me, that I'm free.
Yeah, exactly. Right. This is the classic, like, you think about like, I always tell students, trying to remember where I got this, but yeah, like you have, you imagine, and this is like, also this example shows that I'm old, 'cause like it basically only works if people don't all have phones that they can just text each other with. But, you know, you arrange to meet a friend for lunch, and then they never show up. You wait for like an hour. They never get there. And then like you see them the next day, like, what the hell? Right? Like we had plans.
And he's like, well, if we start the Big Bang.
Yeah. If they start doing all that, even if you completely accept their premise, right? You're not gonna say, okay, never mind. Sorry, I got mad. You're right. It wasn't your fault, right? Like this is like that's just not the kind of thing that seems relevant to who what's your fault, or you know, like. This is me, not Dennett here, but like I would say, you know, I would say that like other contexts for which, you know, for which free will might be relevant are, you know, I think like, you know, I'm pretty sympathetic to the idea of like luck egalitarianism, like the idea that even if this isn't the only thing that makes various kinds of inequality bad, one sort of particularly morally offensive kind of inequality can be inequalities that are totally not under the control of the person who gets the short end of the stick, that like, if that's true of an inequality, that's like a prima facie objectionable feature of it. It is a very weak way of stating it, but I mean, I think that's like the part that I'm most confident about. And say, okay, well, what kind of control seems to be relevant there, right? And it's like, well, you know, it seems like, again, if you start going on about the Big Bang and neurons, the laws of physics, it's like, I don't really know that captures what strikes us as unjust about this, right? I think that it's more likely to be about things that's like, given the sorts of capacities you have, you know, psychologically, physically, whatever, given all of that, right? Would there have been something that you could have reasonably done to come out on the top of this inequality, or was that just denied to you, right? That's, yeah.
I think the thing with the example of this person not attending lunch is a good example for the thing I wanted to highlight, because we've talked about free will and compatibilism a lot in this show, and we're probably getting better, especially me, because I have less experience. But one thing I wanted to highlight this time is that I think you highlight in the essay kind of you go from moral responsibility. And I think a lot of people hear that and get their backs up, especially because people are commonly online moral realism deniers, or they don't really see the connection between the two. They're like, well, okay, that's one thing, but this seems like another thing. Right. But I think if you think about it in more generic terms, in terms of like just blamability, and you think about, you know, there's people you would blame for attending a lunch dinner for not attending a lunch dinner, and there's people who you wouldn't. Like, if you made a plan with your dog, Lucy.
Right.
But then Lucy did something else, even though you'd informed them. And, you know, not just in the sense, like, imagine you in some sense could communicate to Lucy the point. Like, through kind of elaborate.
Yeah, you'd still
Lucy to understand that tomorrow you're going to go out at some point. If that the next day Lucy then decided to do something else, We still wouldn't blame the dog, because we just don't think they have the sort of capacities to make that relevant. While with a human, we very much do.
Totally. I think
this point of kind of blamability and the fact that we do blame, and this doesn't require us to be moral realists. We can even be like basically like moral nihilists. As long as we have an idea that some entities out there in the world are kind of blamable for not doing things or for doing certain things, but other things aren't, then we can kind of get up the setup to talk about free will in those ways.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? Like, there are lots of things. I mean, we could even bring it up a level from Lucy and say, like...
No, I mean, there's obviously... people I know I wouldn't really blame if they didn't do it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't reflect well on that.
You know, but certainly, like, I don't know, my, you know, like, if you imagine, like, a very, very young child, right, who's old enough to talk, right, and like, clearly has some, you know, level of cognitive capacity and, you know, like, understanding of what he's told and all that stuff. And so it's like, it's so like, we believe that he's like capable of remembering the plan, et cetera, right?
You can, like, do mental time travel to imagine like being in the Pizza Hut.
Yeah. It's like, look, there are all kinds of things. And maybe in that case, it's a simple enough thing that you would blame them. You know, but like, it's not a, there are all kinds of things that I wouldn't blame that child for, that I would blame a grown ass man for. Right. Cause like, I think that the grown up has various kinds of cognitive capacities that gives him types of self-control, self-regulation that the...
Yeah, I think this is a very important point for naturalizing free will, because people will often ask or kind of like challenge or question or whatever compatibilism in this way by saying, well, doesn't that mean that some people have more capacity for free will than others? And you're like, yeah, it does. And that, I think, is really helpful in terms of demystifying free will, because then it moves from kind of this floating thing to something that we can clearly define and say, like, yeah, these people are less free, these people are more free. And that's, of course, something we do all the time. Like, of course, we think of, like, chattel slaves as less free than other people.
Yeah. No, I think we can, I think we can absolutely say, I mean, especially if you go, I mean, this takes us a little bit away from Dennett, you know, but, like, if you go with this sort of relatively fine-grained account of free will that I'm most sympathetic to, where you talk about, like, you know, I mean, there's stuff in Dennett that like gets at this, but I mean, it's like the talk about like reason, reasons responsiveness, you know, that like that's clearly a matter of degree, right? Like your ability to understand and be moved appropriately by, you know, reasons for and against different courses of action. It's like clearly that comes in all sorts of degrees, in fact, which is why, you know, even though that fact isn't typically emphasized in explanations of this, if you do read like, you know, academic papers and stuff that lay this out, they'll typically use phrases like adequately reasons responsive, because they're talking about a threshold, right? You know, thresholds come up when things come in degrees, right? So it's like, yeah, I think that like a very, very young child might have more freedom than none, but considerably less than a cognitively standard adult, you know, or at least, you know, I would certainly think so. So yeah. And I think that
maybe bats have a teeny, teeny, tiny bit and then rocks have none.
Yeah. Rocks, certainly none. That much I'm very safe, very, very confident about. You know, only times I've ever seen bats that weren't sleeping are like when they were trapped in like spaces that they didn't want to be in, and so they're just kind of crashing around. And you know,
they are a bit fly-like.
In those moments, at least, they were kind of acting like flies. But I would certainly believe that they have, you know, like,
I mean, there's a Miro test, right? And I guess the window test is a similar sort of thing.
Look, I think it's plausible that bats might have a teensy tiny bit of freedom, but certainly far below any sort of reasonable threshold for moral responsibility. If we did like one of those like weird things that medieval towns would sometimes do when they would like put an animal on trial, right? Like, you know, I would argue in defense of the bat that, you know, is not guilty by reason of mental incapacity, right? I think Dennett is very, very clear in advocating a kind of compatibilism. And he, in fact, right, like where I do, you know, I do say in the essay, right, that I say some mixed things about his record as a new atheist. I think one thing that's very clear is that, you know, if you're just sort of ranking the bad things about different members of the Four Horsemen, you know, there's like no reasonable way to do that that doesn't make Dennett by far the least objectionable. I do disagree with the Charles in the chat about said that, you know, Christopher Hitchens is a warmongering fascist sympathizer. I'd say a warmongering non-fascist. And it is actually, you know, Hitchens.
Yeah, I mean, his whole thing was we're going to win the world war for liberalism.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like he had the very badly mistaken notion that U.S. imperialism could be like a good vehicle for spreading freedom and democracy.
Yeah, like it was basically like a anti-fascism.
Yeah, exactly.
Which they kind of tried to regurgitate, at least in the UK, when they were building up support for bombing Syria.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I wrote an article for Sublation a couple of years ago called "Was It Ukraine and the Spectre of Christopher Hitchens," where I argued that like a lot of kind of center left commentary on that reminded me way too much of the mistakes that late Hitchens was making. But you know, I will also say, you know, even in that period of his life, right? I mean, he still did, after a little bit of waffling, come down on the right side of the torture debate, right? Like, you know, he famously agreed for Vanity Fair to be waterboarded.
Like, after 0.1 seconds, like, it's torture.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, I will say, credit where credit's due, the funniest commentary on that was Norm Finkelstein, who was like, oh, so what would it take to, so, you know, this was like, you know, well, you, are you gonna have to be shot to agree that like murder is bad? You know, I'm fucking it up. The original norm was like much funnier than that, but that was the gist of it. And he actually did co-sign a big class action lawsuit against the use of warrantless surveillance, right? So I wouldn't say as a fascist. I would definitely say he was a warmonger. And if we're comparing if we're doing comparative rankings, it's like, okay, well, Christopher Hitchens as an adult, well, you know, with an enhanced degree of moral responsibility, unlike you, when the Iraq War started, was Christopher Hitchens supported the war in Iraq. So I think on any reasonable point, right, it's like you do the Harry Potter thing at the end of the year, you know, you calculate the points for the houses, right? On any reasonable point system, or like The Good Place, if anybody ever watched that on NBC, you know, they do the points, you know, in the afterlife. Any reasonable system, you get at least 10 million points off for supporting the war in Iraq. Sam Harris, is like, I mean, he's very, I don't actually know that he wrote specifically about Iraq in 2002, 2003, but I mean, like, he was generally, was and is generally extremely neoconish, and to the point that he does his bizarre thought experiment at the end of The End of Faith, where he's like, yeah, we might have to nuke Iran, basically. Which is also just not what thought experiment means, because you're talking about something you think might actually have to happen in the real world. And he was on the wrong side of the torture debate, and, you know, et cetera. He's unbelievably bad on Israel-Palestine, all right, so if Hitchens was Slytherin, what I'm building to is, I think Dennett is like a nice, unobjectionable Hufflepuff. But I think that the, which is also like how bad Harris is on Israel-Palestine is amazing, because given his stated motivations, right, like he should be an anti-Zionist if he was actually be consistent about his stated principles, but he is not. Dawkins, we talked about a couple weeks ago, or last week, maybe, I don't remember. I think there are a zillion problems with Dawkins. Dennett, by far the best of the bunch. I don't think there's any denying that. I think politically, certainly, he was the least political of the four, but like, to the
which can often be the best with professors, especially ones that don't study politics.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, honestly, weirdly enough, right, considering that given his background, it would be the least surprising thing ever if Dennett had been an arch reactionary, since like he spent part of his childhood in Beirut because his dad was like a, you know, high-ranking CIA officer there, and like all this stuff like that.
But we know that the CIA are all libs anyway. Yeah, it's the FBI, though, right wing.
There you go. But it's like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, every time I do see him like make a stray political comment, it's actually good.
What was the elite university that Dennett said he was an ex-liberal?
Oh, I don't know.
We talked about on the show last week, as a UCLA liberal or something. I can't, like an Ivy school. Basically, said he was like an Ivy school liberal. But the point, I was just going to make a joke that, like, well, now that means like building encampments and resisting the police as you fight the genocide in Palestine.
Yeah. I mean, he in Consciousness Explained, there's like a stray joke about the Laffer curve, which was this like bit of like horrendously stupid pop economics that was used to justify austerity, And like he sort of makes a passing joking reference to it. It's like, this looks a bit like Laffer curve, the intellectual, if we can say that, foundation of Reaganomics. And like there's a so in something that's mentioned in the essay, actually, so in Leon Vizeltier, the New Republic guy, that guy, he had reviewed Doc Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell, for the New York Times. Dennett wrote like a, you know, kind of, you know, wrote like a pretty blistering like letter to the editor in reply. And in that letter to the editor, he's like talking about how stupid he thinks it is to be accused of, you know, being a, you know, of scientism. And one of his examples of like, is he's like, oh, are we going to accuse people of being thisists for being, you know, meteorologists, you know, for thinking that, you know, that, you know, that you can't, you know, appease the gods or whatever to get better weather, or are we going to accuse them of being economists for, you know, for reporting factual information about the growing wealth gap between rich and poor? So it's like, oh, hey, you know, like when on the apparently extremely rare occasions that Daniel Dennett had a political thought, honestly, they mostly seem to be good ones. But yeah, he's not, you know, he's just not super political. So, you know, he wasn't doing things like supporting torture, the Iraq war, or, you know, or mulling about the possibility that we might sadly need to commit nuclear genocide against Iran. So, you know, that's good. I do think that his, you know, and I also think that he's like more careful about some of the philosophy of religion stuff in what he says about that in Breaking the Spell than the others are in their equivalent books, which makes sense. His focus still isn't really where I would like it to be, right? You know, that he's sort of more interested in this kind of...
Right, like he's aware of what the actual arguments are, but he's not really interested in talking to them instead of telling like a sociological story about kind of the origins of religion.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, like he does, but where he does push back hard, I think, against the philosophical limitations of his Horse Brothers, or at least one of them in particular, is Sam Harris on free will, right? That they Dennett is actually one of, I believe, I reread this not that long ago last year when I was writing about it for the Substack, that Harris Dennett is one of two compatibilists who gets even a passing mention in Harris's free will book. The other one is Eddie Namias, because Namias wrote an article about it for the New York Times that Harris saw. But then Dennett, I looked this up when I was writing this, Dennett wrote a very long review of the free will book, which is really pretty funny, because I think he thinks he's trying really hard to be nice.
Harris sees through him.
Harris sees through it, right? Where he's like, oh, this is so, like, essentially he's like, hey, you know, man, you did a really well-written book, and it's so intellectually useful that all these...
You really tried, buddy.
You know, it's like, that's probably what a lot of people are thinking, and you crystallized it. It made it really obvious why it was wrong, right? You know, it's like, so, you know, this is an important part of the process, that, you know, you make things clear enough that, you know, they, everybody can see why it's complete nonsense, right? Like, it's essentially a very light paraphrase of what he says here. And, you know, Harris is like, yeah, fuck you. Okay. You know, you're being like, he resents the condescension, and, you know, they go back and forth about it. And then they also do a debate about it, in-person debate, which I think there's only audio of, but it is, the audio is on YouTube. And, you know, it's a very, like, you know, it kind of goes the way you'd expect. Harris accuses Dennett of, you know, changing the subject, that he's talking about something other than free will and trying to sneakily rebrand it as free will, which, you know, again, my take is that I think this is just not a very, like, this is not an accusation that, like, I feel pretty underwhelmed by that accusation, because I think the sort of more useful way to think about it is like, look, there are lots of of factors that we could be free from as we're making decisions. And some of those have to do with determinism and some of them don't. There are lots of capacities we could have or not have. There are lots of senses in which something could be up to us or not, right? And some of those are compatible with determinism and some of them aren't. And so far, I've said nothing that like a thoughtful free will skeptic would disagree with, right? Like I think they could co-sign everything I've said so far. So it seems to me that the philosophically interesting question isn't like how, you know, what's the, you know, because you could say like, oh, well, here's the really interesting question. You know, what do ordinary people mean when they say free will? It's like, eh, I think it depends on context. It's, I don't think most people like, I think most people have somewhat mixed intuitions about this. And in my experience, certainly, if you kind of give out of context any number of different definitions of free will, like you'll get most undergraduates to nod along with them. That sounds right. Right. Cause people, yeah, people have kind of, it's like, oh yeah, that kind of sounds like it captures some of what I mean. Some of the time I use this phrase, right? Like, I don't think just sort of doing like linguistics on this is that philosophically interesting, right? I don't think that like just kind of trying to investigate like which definitions most people will nod along to or whatever that interesting. I think the interesting question is, okay, when we talk about some more important, you know, some like philosophically weighty concept like moral responsibility, for example, or you know, maybe even if you buy into some kind of like existentialist thing about how our, you know, identities or, you know, our life meaning is like shaped by our free decisions or something, then maybe that, right? You know, but it's like some philosophically weighty concept that incorporates free will, say, okay, which of these many things that somebody could mean by freedom or control or being up to them seems to be relevant for that, right? And I think that's where the more interesting debate, you know, is going to end up happening. But yeah, I, you know, if you, and yeah, this is why, as much as I'm not a fan of Mr. Harris and his politics and his interventions in philosophy, this is why I actually do sort of wish that the New York Times had asked him if he wanted to write the obituary, because if nothing else, one, it would have been a more respectful obituary. And, you know, I think that whatever you think of Dennett, he deserved better than this. And two, you know, having spent so much time arguing with Dennett about this, at least Harris would know what he thought.
I don't know if you missed it, but there was an important clarification from the Dennis hater.
Oh, yes.
Which he was calling him Dennis because he was doing this all through text-to-speech or speech-to-text.
Okay.
A very funny image of as listening to us, he's like shouting at his phone about Dennis.
Yeah, it makes more sense, although it's less funny to me than if, you know, he was just like, again, you know, he thought there's this guy we all knew, Dennis, who really sucked, and he wanted to know why Dennis was being praised, or I don't know. Maybe he thought we were talking about Dennis from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It's like, what? That guy's horrible.
The other very important news is that I compared Dennett to Hume last week, and here is Dennett wearing the Hume hat.
That's awesome.
The Hume hat, which I don't know if anyone's ever worn apart from Hume and now Dennett.
But yeah, there you go.
Funny little hat. What's for next week, Ben?
Okay, so next week, well, there's no stream that includes me. So if you want to do a solo stream, you can do it then.
Cool. Yeah. So I've had a brewing thing if I really want to talk about June 2.
Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna be next week. Next weekend I'm gonna be in New Jersey. I'm going to, be speaking at Princeton, it's going to be next Friday at 3:30, I don't think they have a room number yet, but it's like the I'm doing a Israel Palestine talk for the like Alliance of Jewish Progressives at Princeton, and then I'm going to be the guest speaker at the Green Party of New Jersey thing, like a state convention, I guess, the next day, and then I'm going to be on a plane on Sunday. I am. This is as good a time as any to quickly promo this. So I'm also not planning on doing a real essay next Sunday. Instead, I'm just going to write something up, talking a bit more in depth about the upcoming Capital class, since that is going to start 2 weeks from today. So if you've always wanted to read Capital, if perhaps you started a reading group during the pandemic, but then you never quite got through it, as many people don't, this is a great chance to do this. If nothing else, you know, you can think you're much more likely to get through it in a context like this, and then you'll be in that blessed select group of humanity who's read Capital all the way through. I think it's really, I think you'll really find that it is worth your while. I'm really looking forward to, I've not only read it, but I taught a previous class about it, but I am really looking forward to digging back into it again, because it's for me, so it's going to meet. So again, starting Sunday after next, it's going to meet Sunday. So Sunday from 1 to 3 Eastern time, right? So that's 10 a.m. to noon here in Los Angeles. And when I was doing this before, it was always just like a really nice way to start off my Sunday. Spend 2 hours talking about Capital. I actually love that.
Is it going to make you earlier or later for this?
It's an interesting question. I have the problem is that I time travel badly, right? Like I have
you're constantly self-deluded about your own capacities and speed.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, I know I have such and such amount of time, and I'm going to plan around it, and then I end up doing it a little bit badly, and coming on it.
You're like, I can get McDonald's breakfast in like 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. This is it's an interesting debate to be had about the extent to which this cognitive impairment of mine is responsibility diminishing. But in any case, probably about the same. But really, really looking forward to that. Really excited about doing it again. And I think if you just people get weird in all sorts of ways about Marx, but I think if you just kind of, read him like any other historical thinker, where you're like, all right, here's what he's saying. Let's figure out what the argument is here. Here's some interesting debate.
Yeah, don't worry about people like owning you online if you get it wrong, because if you just read the book, you almost certainly know more than them.
Yeah, that is also a major feature of the class. So yeah, if anybody wants to sign up for that, doing it through the Patreon, so that's patreon.com/BenBurgess. Again, I'm going to be in New Jersey next weekend, but the class will start the weekend after that. Really looking forward to that. And 2 Sundays from now, we can either talk finally talk about the Norm essay from last week, in which case.
Well, clearly, since you've got like a month to do it, you need to use that time to get Norm on.
Yeah, I will. I will send the man an email. He's very. My Norm experience is that it used to be very, very easy to book Norm, and it's gotten a bit more difficult.
He's famous since the genocide.
Yeah. Exactly. I'll send Norm an email, see if we can get him on for that. But anyway, so if we did that, that would like just kind of get us back to being a week behind. So we're thinking about, but yeah, looking forward to it.
So today I changed my lighting. Everyone, don't know if you noticed. from trying to make myself appear tanned to only very slightly trying to make myself tanned. But I was also thinking maybe next week I'll use the real Hyperborean lighting, which is this, and just be blue.
Nice.
So that's just something for you to reflect on as we
will do. Finish our
outro button. Bye.